Welcome to MLM After Hours on Building Fortunes Radio. You can listen in live to MLM After Hours here or listen anytime in the future by selecting the MLM After Hours broadcast segments on www.buildingfortunesradio.com. Building Fortunes Radio supports our members and everyone looking for their personal level of success in the home-based business industry. Your host for Building Fortunes Radio is Peter Mingle, owner of PM Marketing and Network Lead. On this segment of Building Fortunes Radio, Peter will be introducing you to the MLM After Hours. MLM After Hours is also sponsored by Doris Wood and the MLMIA. The Multi-Level Marketing International Association has been serving the industry for over 28 years, and you can join us on the MLMIA segment every Monday at 8:30 p.m. Eastern. The MLM industry has always been confusing and controversial in some areas concerning policies, procedures, rules, regulations, and compliance issues. MLM After Hours will be joined by guest hosts that are familiar with these controversial subjects. Dr. Keith Lagos, Len Clements, Mel Atwood, Doris Wood, and other MLM After Hours guests have had their share of experiences and will share their views with us now. So how about it? Let's get this show started. Here's Peter.
Hello, everyone. Peter Mingles here. We're on the Building Fortunes Radio, and we are here on MLM After Hours. This segment was not supposed to happen tonight. It was supposed to happen the first Monday of every month. However, when we ran our first segment on the first Monday of every month at 10 p.m. Eastern, we had so many people ask, can we do this more frequently than once a month? So we determined that we will do this radio show every odd Monday evening of every month. Now, what does that mean? Odd means the first, the third, and if there's a fifth, we'll do one on the fifth. So this is the third Monday of the month of May 19th, 2014, for those people that are listening in, because some of the information that we provide for you may be dated or some of it may be timeless. So I am here as your initial guest host, but we have a lot of really qualified and quality people on the line listening in. We have Mel Atwood. We have Dr. Keith Lagos. We, of course, have Doris Wood, who's the MLMIA President Emeritus, as well as Chairperson, and we have Carol LeClaire, and I think we have somebody coming in from Oregon. So who's our 541 caller? I think we have somebody from Oregon. Doris, do we have anybody from Oregon on?
Michael.
Is that Michael?
Oh, Michael Linden.
And it might be Michael Linden. So he came on right on time. We didn't get a chance to introduce him, so thank you very much for being here, if that's Michael. So thanks for everyone for being here, and we are going to talk about a whole bunch of stuff today. One of them is going to be on the concept of sales. The other one is going to be on the concept of sales requirements. Then we're going to talk about coded bonuses. And lastly, why the status of distributor must remain as independent. But as we're going to share our views, I am going to somehow or another find our little disclaimer. So those people listening in, wait about 45 seconds. Here we go.
The MLM After Hours radio segment on Building Fortunes Radio is protected by local and international copyright laws. No portion or variation of this show can be duplicated, modified, or reproduced in any format without the express written consent of all parties participating on the MLM After Hours show. More information is available on www.buildingfortunesradio.com. MLM After Hours can provide the helpful information you may use to succeed in the home-based business industry. The entire content of this show consists of the research and experience, the opinions and the views of the callers, guests, and the hosts on this show. It does not constitute legal advice or specific counsel for you, as each individual should always seek individual guidance and counsel for matters related to themselves specifically.
Okay, we're back. We are here on MLM After Hours, and this is our segment hosted by the MLMIA. So, Doris, as this is hosted by you, we're going to talk about sales or sales requirements. We spoke on our very first training or very first conference call or radio show about the concept of sales and how much is it important. I'm going to let you start the transition, if you will, of sales and sales requirements in our industry.
You know, I feel that this is something that our guests and all of the people, and they're not really guests, they're going to be regular participants on this show, I think that they would have much more say, because my idea of sales is for the association, and of course I'm very familiar with the sales in this industry, having worked with it for so many years, but I really, really feel that that because we had such good participation the last time and so many people wanted them to continue it, I think it's just a good thing. And so I'm going to ask Mel if he'll get into this.
Well, sure.
And then we'll all pick at him.
Well, you know, the idea of sales, and this kind of goes off of our show last week or 2 weeks ago, about retail sales, and specifically here we talk about sales and sales requirements. I actually had an interesting conversation with a client today, or potential client, I should say. They called me up. They started explaining to me their compensation plan, and he said to me, auto ships are required. And I listened to him, and I went through, and then I paused him, and I said, you know that may be legally challenging. And he said, what do you mean everybody does it? It's kind of an interesting thing. We talk about sales requirements and sales and understanding, you know, internal consumption versus consumption by customers, or what we would maybe even call retail sales or retail consumption, and how those play out. I think there's a lot of misunderstanding in our space that as long as you have a product and that people are buying, that somehow that legitimizes you and justifies you as a multiple marketing company. And that couldn't be farther from the truth. From a legal perspective, we kind of talked about this a little bit, and so I'm kind of carrying over from our last radio show just a little bit. The intent or the motive, the reason why someone is buying the product, is extremely important to determine whether a business model is actually a pyramid or not, whether it's a legitimate multi-level marketing company. And so we start talking about sales requirements. Sales requirements are good. Purchase requirements are not good. And that's like black and white, and it sometimes there's some gray in there. But what I wanted to say in terms of sales and sales requirements is, look, we need to have more products in our industry that people look at and say, I want to buy that product because I love the product, not just because there's some business opportunity associated with it. So, I mean, one of the things I would say there in terms of sales requirements, it's a pretty fundamental principle of legality in our space to have sales requirements in order to reach either commission levels for multiple tiers or to climb the ranks, reach incentive levels. Sales are just central. What I want
to
do is Carol, what is your thoughts on that?
Just to earn money.
Yeah, absolutely.
Just to earn sales commissions. Sale, product activity in this industry is a requirement. However you deem that product, if it's sold for personal consumption and that distributor is running their business correctly, then they are selling the product to themselves, which is still a sale. But
absolutely. You can be your own customer. It's just when you cross the line and require that to be a required product purchase versus a required sales requirement, correct?
So we're gonna stick on this definition because there is two different things that Mel is talking about over here.
Yeah.
Because one was auto ship. So he tied the word auto ship in there, and then he also tied the probably innocent response from that person that was thinking about hiring you guys as consultants of saying we're going to make auto ship required because everybody else does. So your mom or your dad or somebody else talking to you would be saying, well, if everybody else also jumped off the bridge, would that mean it would be right? And the answer would probably be not in that example, but doesn't everybody, it feels like quote unquote everybody, have an auto ship program? And isn't that what guarantees our financial security, for lack of a better expression? So we're gonna continue to talk about those two things because there's two different differences here. Carol's talking about go out there and sell something, somebody. And then the company is saying you have to have an auto ship to be able to qualify maybe for compensation. Now, I'm going to just
– Peter?
Did somebody want to – yes. Go ahead, Keith.
Can I interrupt for a second?
This please.
Is Keith. One, Mel's right in that you can have an auto ship, but it can't be required. It can be optional.
Right.
But there's a third requirement that they're looking at. I've been expert witness many times. I was meeting with the state attorneys for a client or case, and they brought up a third issue I've heard before, too. One is, you know, how much customers do you have, retail customers, those who buy outside opportunity, as you know. Third is you know, the value of the product, but within that value of the product, they were asking and making a point how much of the product is actually getting being used by both the distributor and the retail customer. Is the product actually being consumed, or is it being warehoused? As you know, it then goes into inventory stacking and how many people bought products every month just to make the qualifications, and they stack up, fill the basement, garage, and everywhere else. So they also look at not only who's buying the product, but how much of that product's being used. That's the third factor they look at.
And that's very valuable, Keith, because we have this underbelly of our industry called garage qualifying, mm-hmm. the behavior that people do in this space or have done in this space. It's a bad behavior where they will, and it goes into part of that front, you know, that front-end inventory loading piece too. But there's also, so we talk about that, we can go in that in just a second, but there's that garage qualifying mechanism that because mm-hmm. of the way that our qualifications are set up, if I am, let's say, $1,000 away from qualifying at X rank, then what do they do? Well, they might go down line and buy X amount of product for a certain amount of money, qualify themselves, and as a result, override their overall sales organization a lot deeper. So what happens is we get people that are buying product in the business that is never actually consumed. And so that's why whenever you hear the Direct Selling Association or Attorney General's talking about it, and specifically the law that was just passed in Tennessee by my good friend and attorney Kevin Thompson, we sort of pushed that through a little bit, specifically talking about internal and the word consumption, not just internal sales or internal purchases, specifically going to that point, Keith, and that's really, really critical. I mean, this is product that is intended to be consumed. If people are just buying it to qualify in the plan, then we've got an issue. There's some sort of systemic issue at play there.
I just want to jump in for one. Yep, hold on 1 second, Dr. Keith. I just want to jump in for 1 second because for the people that are listening in, we're here on the MLM After Hours show, and you may not be familiar with the backgrounds of the people that are speaking. You're listening to Mel Atwood. Mel's been a distributor, a company owner, an advocate for the industry, a software vendor, a consultant. If there's a thing that he's done it all. Dr. Keith, in a similar situation, also is the owner of a network marketing magazine called the Network Marketing Business Journal, previously known as Moneymakers Monthly. And Dr. Keith has been around for a really long period of time. So you have two people that are really talking at a very educated level about some issues. I'm going to dumb it down a little bit just for an example. When Mel was talking about the purchasing of something, if there was a requirement of, say, for instance, $2,000 or $3,000. Let's pick the number $3,000. You needed to have a sales volume in your sales organization of $3,000 for you to be able to get paid an extra percentage or another few levels deep. The natural tendency for some people, if they only had $2,000, and remember the requirement is $3,000, the natural tendency might be for somebody to whip out their credit card, buy an extra $1,000 for the sole purpose of hitting the bonus as opposed to really having the sales associated with that. And I grew up in the direct sales industry, and we didn't do that all the time. But we did it often enough because we knew that we would always be able to sell the products. Like, for instance, one of my very first contests I ever won, I bought a couple of extra vacuum cleaners because I was shooting for a prize. I needed 50, so I bought like two extra just in case. They were on sale. I would be able to resell them a little bit later on. Yes, it violated the company policies, but realistically, kind of like everybody did it in that industry, everybody that was sharp, kind of quote-unquote, did it in that industry, the leaders, the ones that kind of thought about this stuff, they did it sometimes in that industry, but we didn't have a garage fulls of those things. I bought two that I'd be selling in the next couple of days, and that wasn't garage qualified. Mel, the example that you used a little bit earlier is month after month after month, perhaps, someone's buying that extra $1,000 so they can get that extra bonus somewhere else. So for all those people that are listening in, I just wanted to put some real numbers with everyday examples of sometimes what we run across, because Mel is great at explaining things. Dr. Keith is great at explaining things. But if you're a brand new person, I hopefully was able to put it into real-life situations of what's happening. And these issues are current today. These aren't things that happened many, many years ago. These are things that are happening right now. So back to you, Dr. Keith. You can punctuate, clarify, explain anything that I might have just said.
No, what you said was great. My point was that, in addition to what I said, was that what state attorneys have said that DSA MI means directly to myself and my clients is what they're trying to achieve is that not only the company has product, but there's value to that product. And they use retail sales, lack of garage qualifying sales, and all these other measurements to measure the true value of the product. Because if the product's truly valuable, they say you will have retail sales and people won't have to buy product for the garages because it can be able to sell it straight out, just like your vacuums. You did buy a couple of extra, but you were able to sell them. So you didn't have a garage full because those vacuums were valuable. So when it comes to retail sales and measure of value of the product, that goes to Mel's point of intent of purchasing, they use these other measurements as a meter to judge, is the product really valuable? Is it really getting, is there a market outside of people buying it just for the opportunity? In both Mel's case and what you say, Peter, that is what they're trying to ascertain. Is there a market for the product that people will buy it without the opportunity, or are they buying it strictly because of the opportunity? That's the litmus test that they are trying to achieve.
Well, to get back to the original thing, though, is that Mel was talking about auto shipment. And the point is that auto shipments are great, but they are not required. You do not have to purchase auto shipment. That's up to the individual, and companies cannot require auto shipment.
Well,
they can't even require personal purchases. All they can require is sales volume.
That's right, in order to qualify for a bonus or for commissions or whatever.
Autoship is fabulous for the companies to gauge their volume and do projections for purchasing product ahead, et cetera, et cetera. However, the fact that autoship is a convenience, you know, I'm going to take these vitamins and I'm going to take them every month, so
right.
I need X amount. Sometimes it's very convenient, and that's really how it came about, is the convenience of it, getting the customer registered on an auto ship so it just automatically is delivered to them, and it is a great service. However, so many companies try to sneak in that you can't earn any wholesale compensation or commissions, and you can't advance in the program unless you're on auto ship, and that means when they put that into their program and they perpetuate that culture within their company, it means that everyone that sponsors someone else has to have X number of people on autoship, and that's what is not an option. You have to have people registered on autoship or you cannot advance and get paid. That's where it's a really big problem. But, you know, last week I mentioned the fact that, you know, the industry has changed over the years. People can order online, and they can order product and have it delivered with just a click of a button. So the urgency for autoship is not so – it's really geared towards the company's benefit, not so much the customer anymore, and certainly towards the sponsoring distributor who is signing up a new person, and they're going to get a compensation from that auto ship. So there's many misconceptions out there, but the regulators are not looking favorably at any company that has auto ship in as part of a requirement.
Confused the issue a little bit now is many services are being sold through network marketing and direct sales, such as telephone services, electric you know, utility services, things that require, even insurances, a monthly payment. So, and it's common to have a monthly payment for those things for both retail customers and distributors who are using those services.
Mm-hmm.
So in that regard, it's pretty hard for the state attorneys to argue against a auto payment for those services, which is an auto shipment.
that's a little bit different because they're delivering a service that's consumed. If I'm getting my electric bill on with a company, that's a product that is obviously being consumed every month, and that's like an auto payment. It's not an auto delivery. And I think it has a different connotation.
A little bit different, but a lot of times
I
paid a month.
I would still make the case, however, that required personal consumption service or product is still, whether it's auto ship subscription, whether whatever the mechanism of purchase is, it's still an underlying issue that we need to look at, because when an attorney general looks at what a company is doing in terms of their sales mechanisms, if what they see is a endless chain of participant enrolling other participants that consume, enrolling other participants that consume, what they see is a pyramid. And so this is why we go back to what the Fortune High Tech ruling was, where, you know, they pointed out that 81% of the sales happening in Fortune High Tech was happening through purchases internally, and this was one of the factors that they used in their determining factor. So one of the things we need to be very careful of, and this goes back to the motive, why am I buying all of those sorts of things, understanding, again, Keith, that the product has value as you have stipulated. What they're trying to get to is that people's motives for buying this product are pure and authentic, that the reason they're consuming it, the reason they're on the subscription, the reason they're on the auto ship is because they want that service. And as you continued, Keith, you said, rather there was a business associated with it or not. And that's a really, really critical component. I have heard leaders, I've gone to meetings, I've participated and listened to these people on their conference calls say phrases like, the product doesn't matter. What matters is the compensation plan. When we hear those kinds of things,
wow.
An attorney general gets on a conference call and hears those kinds of things.
You're right, absolutely.
Yeah.
Those,
yeah,
I get rid of you too.
So far out there that now all of a sudden what the attorney general is hearing is, oh, this is just another endless chain, a pyramid, and then that's where companies get in trouble. So sales are the key, and sales, authentic sales, true sales, whether it comes from a subscription, whether it comes from an auto ship, correct me if I'm wrong, but it needs to be authentic. The reason you're buying is because you want to consume that product or use that service.
Yeah, precisely. That's what the point is.
I think
we
all agree on that.
Yeah. We're looking at other products really being consumed by the distributors and the customers. So that's one of the measures they are using to determine, is that the reason why they're buying the product? Because obviously if the product is not being consumed by the distributors,
do we really have that much anymore of any garage qualified? Because remember, you used to be able to buy $5,000 worth of product, and you can't do that anymore as an individual.
No, you can, unfortunately. There are a lot of companies that's still an issue out there. I don't want to go into the names.
Well,
some of them might be my advertising clients.
Whereas if we move your question towards quoted bonuses, then we get up into that dollar value, because quoted bonuses are often introduced in pack formats where their packages are pre-packaged, ready to go out the door to a new distributor when they join up. And the idea of quoted bonuses is that it pays the sponsor and the upline, and the company moves.
Recruiting.
Pardon me?
They look at it a lot of times as a recruiting bonus.
Yes, and that is
so. Carol,
what it should
help
be at
help
all.
The news person, if you don't mind, Carol, help the news person that might be listening in who has never heard the term coded bonus. So what does that mean? Give us a definition. So what is a coded bonus?
Well, you know, I'm this lowly Canadian on board here, so I'll give you my version of how I understand it. And one of the there's many variations of it, but we'll get Keith to add in at the end because he's much more familiar with what it is in the U.S. Coded bonuses is a reasonably new coined term that has just come into play in the last two and a half to three years that it's become quite prominent, and that is that in every case with clients that I deal with, it's distributors who want to be awarded when product is sold and they sign a new distributor. It really is a signing bonus for the upline. But the companies tend to endorse it because it moves, you know, packs of products. I don't know, maybe it's $100 here and $300 and $600 or $5,000, whatever, prepackaged amounts that are ready to be shipped to a new distributor immediately. When that sales transpires and the new distributor, because they don't really know what to buy in the very beginning, maybe at the first meeting, they know they want to be involved, but they're not sure what to order. So the packs are there for a good reason, because it helps them get a sampling of maybe a variety of products and try it out. You know, the company has a refund policy, so that's good. But the coded bonuses are what is awarded not so much to the distributor, but the commission on that is paid to the sponsor and sometimes the sponsor's sponsor. And so,
Carol, what you're describing is usually called in the United States fast start bonuses, the fast start
or first order bonuses.
Yeah, we've had those for years. Bonuses.
And they usually also have a little bit more of a discount for the person who's buying it, but the commissions are paid to only, like you said, limited number upline, with the majority of those commissions going to the person who sold it, in order that that person can break even and make money as a new sponsor faster. And they're called fast start bonuses or first start, first pack bonuses, and so forth. Coding bonuses, I understand, usually is more around training requirements to advancement. Is that right, Mel? Have you found that to be the case?
Yeah, actually, I was having this conversation with Peter, and so thank you for bringing it up, because before the call and before the show, what I was mentioning is that the phrase coded bonus, much like the word compression or infinity, these words have over the years evolved and changed to have different meanings. It's sort of interesting when Zengo came out with their compression, they called it dynamic compression. Now everybody wants to take normal compression and add the word dynamic to it. And there's a difference between dynamic compression and compression. The reason I'm saying this is because we've got a bit of a semantics issue here. And I think that what Carol's specifically talking about is exactly that. Those sales that are sold on the front end that are product front end, and we could consider these garage qualified, because some of these amounts of products and some of these front packs are enormous. And in today's world, where the bulk of people are not buying it wholesale, turning around and selling it retail, we're not using an arbitrage mechanism. For the most part, one of those changes that Carol is happening in our space is that for the most part, arbitrage, I mean, it's a really minor part of a company's business or an independent professional's business. But what happens then is it's a way, or it has been a way, for companies to create this head-hunting bonus, because we cannot pay a recruiting fee. So then they put in place these bonuses and ultimately say, well, you can be grandfathered in, or they'll give you some sort of an incentive mechanism. If you buy this pack, you get, you know, unlock this part of the plan and unlock that part of the plan, which is kind of a passive-aggressive compulsory requirement to get them to buy these bigger amounts. And so you get new independent professionals sitting in those events. They're excited. They feel the possibility of their lives changing. And through that excitement, then the close happens. If you want to do this right, you need to come in at the premium intergalactic stellar pack, you know, up here. If you're going to do this the right way, that's the way you do it. And so there's this compulsion and pressure that gets exerted on that initial enrollment to buy it. And so we end up with garage qualifying in that front end. The coded bonus, and since this is not part of the topic of what we're doing right now, I will address it just briefly, just to say that coded bonus is an evolution out of the Australian 2-up. Instead of the Australian 2-up where you give up your first two sales in the front part of your plan, what happens is companies evolve that to be in the later part of the plan where your fourth, fifth, sixth, or seventh legs or so on and so forth, the first several number of people in those legs to infinity, you would earn an overriding code to. So if you ever heard of Legacy for Life, that we always talked about leaving a legacy for someone else, the first three legs of our business would be the legacy we left for somebody else who was coding to that business up the tree somewhere. So the semantics are, play a role. I think most of us would call what Carol's talking about a first-order bonus or a fast-start bonus in the United States.
Well, it's the same practice, Mel. They just have different names and different terms. It
yep.
really is rewarding the upline as opposed to the giving the best possible benefit, and it's an enticement. I use a couple words when I'm looking at and reviewing plans, and that is that does this plan have an incentive format or does it have an enticement format? Because when they're selling packs and they're selling coded bonuses or they're front-end loading in any way, it often has an enticement format, which is always questioned by any of the regulators.
Yeah. So
there's another simpler. There's another simpler term I've heard used too. Is you cannot have a pay-to-play requirement in your program. In other words, pay so you can earn commissions, pay to by buying stuff, or pay so you can get higher ranks or higher commissions or higher incentives. There cannot be a pay-to-play component to a comp plan.
And let me add one thing to that, because sometimes what I've seen companies do and is that they'll make these packs only available to independent professionals or distributors.
First 30 days.
And so, yeah, I mean, what happens then is an attorney general looks at that and goes, well, oh, if a distributor is the only one who can buy this, then it's not a, you know, it's a sales tool or it has another classification. Kevin Thompson, I mentioned this on our last show, talks about the $1,000 glass of lemonade. If on the preponderance of the evidence, it appears that the bulk of people that are buying these are buying them to qualify for something. They're not necessarily buying it from an authentic place. This goes back to that whole why are you buying it reason. It becomes suspect, and as Carol said, you know, the regulators really don't want to see that. But, and so let's talk about the other side of it. Why is it there? It's not just self-serving to the company. I have just helped with a client that just barely launched as we were working through and designing their plan, and some of the leaders were reviewing it that were getting started at the very beginning. You know, they were asking questions like, because we had limited the initial optional pack sizes to actually under $200, and some of the leaders were asking questions of, well, can I sell five of those? And what starts to happen is that, and this is an interesting point when we talk about sales, what is the degree of effort, what extra degree of effort is there at the level of an independent professional to sell something that's $200 versus sell something that's $1,000? What's the degree of effort difference? Very small. It's there, but it's very small difference. If I've got someone hooked and excited to get them to spend $200 versus get them to spend $1,000, and yet my payoff and my reward is so much greater, when we talk about incentives and behaviors and when we think about how our business compensation plans are designed, we really have to look at what are we really incentivizing people to do. And this is one of those things where leaders, being in this rationally self-interested for themselves to make money, they do what they can to optimize, that's the nice way of saying it, manipulate or abuse is the other side of it, to optimize the plan to their best advantage. And so you've got to be very careful in the design of your compensation plan, your incentive models as well, to determine, you know, what what are the behaviors that we are going to allow, and how is that going to play? So we have to understand the mechanisms in the human psyche of what's actually happening in those transactions. Leaders want those big bonuses because it's not that much harder for them to close them, and
however,
they get so much more the reward for doing it.
I agree with you 100%. However, one of the first things that, you talk about when you have an MLM potential company that wants to start up and you take them as a client, I want to know what kind of culture they want to create, because some of these packs and some of these coded bonuses have been pressured by the marketers, by the top leaders in the marketplace. They put pressure on the new company owners to put them in place because of exactly what you just explained, Mel. It's very, very easy to move a first transaction from $200 to $2,000 while they're excited, while the euphoria is there and everybody's anxious to get involved. However, what kind of a culture does the company want to create for a short term, for a long term? And I think the culture of these companies and how they want to have long-term sales activity, and what kind of product, back to Keith's question about is it a regular consumable product, I think the culture of these companies that are coming into the marketplace is really, really important.
Speaking of culture, the initial introduction of these large sales packs came from actually party plan and direct sales companies, where you would need a large sample of various products to do a party. So it was very proper and necessary for distributors to buy the large packs. Then it spilled over to network marketing, I think, where it was more of a income incentive and an advancement in rank and commissions. But these sample packs, as they used to be called, have been around a long time, and party plans could justify them, because to do a party, you need inventory and you need samples.
Absolutely. I can even remember when we did that, and we used to encourage leasing companies to lease the kits to the people so we'd get paid more money.
But you didn't have a computer that they could view everything online and order on the spot either, did you?
No, but
they had a list of everything they got. It wasn't, I mean, they saw everything they were going to get. But it was just an incentive for them to purchase more at one time so that we'd make more money and the company would sell more.
Well, and that's the thing. I was used an analogy recently where if we want to think about how our businesses are growing, and we've seen several case studies, if we'll look at some of the meteoric rises of some of the titans that are now currently in the top 100, the DSN top 100, you look at some of their meteoric rises. This is phenomenal growth, over $800 million in 5 or 6 years. And what we see is that they're using some of these mechanisms to throw large amounts of volume out initially, drawing lots of leaders that can show them big checks, and it generates a huge amount of buzz and a huge amount of excitement. But specifically the one company I'm looking at now and or thinking of now, and some of the other companies that are out there that have done similar things, what we find is that they recede substantially. Now the one company is less than $500 million a year. They've almost gone in half to somewhere around $425 million a year. And part of this is, and the analogy that I wanted to use, was as we're thinking about working with, or as independent professionals, as we're looking at the companies that we're choosing to grow with, we can identify where they are in the swing of their business, identify the type of culture Carol brings in, which is a huge, huge point. But if we will factor in then, too, are we in this for that cliche but also true thing, that long-term residual income, or are we looking for that huge one-time shot in the arm? I think that in our immediate gratification world today, what ends up happening is independent professionals want that immediate hit, and so they start joining and participating in balsa wood companies versus looking for and participating in oak companies, fast growth companies with that have pithy wood that split and die quickly, versus companies that are designed and structured for longevity that build slightly slower in the process, but last then forever.
Yes. Yes.
And I think that what we need to do is we really need to teach our independent professionals to really pay attention to the types of companies that they're thinking about joining, look at the sales requirements, look at the culture of sales that they have, and really look at this. Is this a type of company that is based upon authentic, true consumption of product, or are people just throwing product out the door in these garage-qualifying front-end bonuses to generate huge growth, or fast growth, excuse me, with really no stay power? It's really, I think, a dichotomy that is really important for everyone to understand.
You know, one of the things, too, Michael, are you still with us?
Yes, I am.
Well, you know, it seems to me that you and I were talking not too long ago about, you know, there have been companies that are around for a long time, and they change so many methods within their system after a while. And so although they've been around for a long time and people that have been with them for a long time are ready for that residual income, then they make some sudden changes, and all of a sudden they go out of business.
That's right. I'm involved with a company right now that I've been involved with for nearly 30 years, and that's happening right now. And, you know, the company's undergone management changes, and they've undergone comp plan changes. And basically what happens is that the new management does not value what the old distributor network brought to the table. So they discourage the old network from having income. So they change the plan, and they cut into the old network's income and slowly whittle it away. And most of those distributors end up either drifting away or just hanging in there but doing nothing.
So that's a problem that needs to be addressed probably at another time. But that all has to do with sales, because if they're encouraging, if the culture has been for a long time stability, and then all of a sudden they change that and encourage these big sales to every new person coming in rather than letting them grow with it, then that has a lot to do with the sales in any company.
Yes, it does. Now, that doesn't apply in this particular instance or in my experience, but I know exactly what you're talking about, yes.
Okay.
Now, we're referencing a lot of things relative to sales as if we live in a world on our own. I think Keith or maybe Mel or maybe Michael might be able to bring this too as well. Right. As far as the regulators have a line in the sand that they say anything above this actually fits into a different kind of a category. So it's not really always your choice, depending on what state you might be in. So I don't know if anybody wants to address any of those things as well. But, you know, once you hit a certain threshold, now all of a sudden you have other things to worry about. A $200 plan will fly under most of the radar anywhere.
You're talking about the business opportunity laws.
Correct.
And they vary from $200 to $500 and something. The majority of the states don't have them, but there's also a federal business opportunity law that does apply. And once you achieve, and it's
499, isn't
it? I believe so, but like I think it's Rhode Island's 200, some are 300, but most of them are 500, and that's over a 6-month period of required purchases by a new distributor. Now, NORIS has required, like for sales kits and stuff.
Yeah, in California we call it the SAMPAC, S-A-M-P.
If it's for resale, you buy inventory, you show you sold to retail customers, that's okay. They're not limiting how much sales you can make, but how much is required purchases by the distributor. Which if you think about it, on those auto ships, means it has to be less than $100 a month right off the bat. And a lot of the companies look at only at the fast start packages that Carol was describing before. It has to be under 500 or 300 or whatever or 200 for Rhode Island. Luckily, Rhode Island is not very not actively policing that 200 dollar limit for most companies. But those, that's Business Opportunity Act, and now there's a new federal Business Opportunity Act, which they claim direct sales doesn't violate unless it doesn't control direct sales unless direct sales companies violate it. So in a sense, it does. And if you exceed that, then you set yourself for all kinds of extra filing, reporting of average sales by district sales. There's a whole bunch of other laws that you find yourself having to obey as a company, as distributors.
And Mel, I remember,
anyone else want to add to that?
I remember that, Dr. Keith, when those things were going on, when we were all actively involved in the Distributor Rights Association, not only the DRA, but the MLMIA and a lot of other things, we actually had to go fight because we might not even be on the phone in the present condition if the regulators had a chance to run the rules the way they wanted to without having an understanding of how this works in the MLM world. So that's another whole conference call that I think some people, or another whole radio show that some people need to hear about, the business opportunity ruling. We have about 13
minutes.
We
want to make sure Len's on that because Len was very active doing that for that.
Len was very active in that, and you'll hear, if you ever want to hear a radio show where Len and I go at it, that'll be the one that you want to listen to. So it's interesting. That'll be an interesting one, and definitely after hours. And the reason why I say that is because what's written is, and what was actually spoken to me are two different things. So I know Len and I have definitely opposing sides on that. But we have, Doris, we have somebody calling in from the 480 area code, and I don't want to ignore somebody that might have been just late. So you check your thing and see if we should open them up, or it could just be a regular listener, which we appreciate. But I see someone calling in from an area code.
I can't remember everybody's numbers without going, and I have no idea.
We'll them,
so if they're calling
pass.
In at this time, we've only got 10 minutes left. Let's see who it is and welcome them and see if they have a question.
Okay, well, I guess we can open it up. Let's go see. Okay, so who's calling in from the 480 area code? Is it a listener or one of our guests, speakers? I've had them on hold for so long, they might have walked away from the machine. Questions going once, going twice. Okay, so we're going to mute them out for just a second. We'll be back maybe. But we didn't even play your commercial, so let's go for a commercial. We'll be right back. Hold on one second. Yeah, we've been on a roll.
You're listening to the MLM After Hours segment on Building Fortunes Radio. This special segment of MLM After Hours is brought to you by the MLMIA, the Multi-Level Marketing International Association. MLM After Hours will be coming to you the first Monday of every month at 10 p.m. Eastern. Join us live or listen to the MLM After Hours segments on Building Fortunes Radio by visiting www.buildingfortunesradio.com. Tune in often. Our guest hosts will change from segment to segment, and you'll enjoy their pleasing personalities, their experiences, and their points of view. Spread the word. Invite your friends. Share this with your business partners. MLM After Hours will provide the helpful information you may use to succeed in the home-based business industry. The entire content of this show consists of the research and experience, the opinions and the views of the callers, guests, and hosts of this show. It does not constitute legal advice or specific counsel for you, as each individual should always seek individual guidance and counsel for matters related to themselves specifically. We hope you learn from and enjoy MLM After Hours. Thanks for listening, and now back to our show.
Okay, we're back. You're listening to Peter Mingles, Doris Wood. We've heard Keith Lagos, Dr. Keith Lagos, Mel Atwood. We have Michael Linden and Carol LeClaire. Carol introduced in the thought process of what we're going to talk about the concept of independent distributor. If there's one thing that I could mention as we go through this, there's difference in varying opinions. You hear them even maybe on this radio show itself. And this is at levels of people that have been doing this for many decades, perhaps, and have had lots of experiences in different areas. When we talk about the typical distributor that signs up as an independent contractor, they really are of limited knowledge, and maybe they don't really study the industry the way we've been forced, if you want to, or want to study the industry. So an independent distributor takes the word independent and puts it together with distributor, and that means I could do whatever I want because I'm independent, right? And it's not necessarily that way all the time. So it's the same thing with business opportunity. It's a business. It's an opportunity. So, bam, I remember the guy from the Big Fat Greek Wedding, you know. there you go, as you will. Everything is derived from Greece, somewhere or another. So making your own definitions doesn't really fit in this industry, especially at that point where the legal status comes in. So, Carol, you brought it up. I'll let you start it. Why independent distributor? Or why is it important that they stay independent distributors or anything else?
Well, I think one of the things, in my opinion, that makes this industry successful is that the multitude and millions of independent marketers who sign up as distributors must remain independent entities, independent contractors, and there's many names that are used, but they must remain independent and not be employees. That's what makes the whole industry thrive, is that you have all the tools and the mechanisms and all of the support to run an independent business, but you must be and maintain and perform with independent status. Otherwise, you are deemed employed by the marketing company. So a lot of the distributors that are joining, I don't care if it's what names they put on it, I don't care what terms they want to put on it, but they must remain as independent entities because they don't want to get a 1099. They do not want to pay tax as being employed. And so I think it's important for them to understand that's why they must pay a small amount for back office fees, or that they need to run their business as an independent business and run it like a business. There's many aspects of it, but I talk a lot about being an independent contractor and having all the benefits that go with what the companies offer. But companies spend enormous amount of time and effort setting up and getting operational and being in compliance and being registered and licensed and all of these other wonderful things. And the distributor steps in with almost no investment. They need to buy a product, but they really have the best of both worlds, but they must remain as an independent contractor.
You know,
go ahead, Mel.
I was on this topic. It was really frustrating several years ago, many years ago. A leading CEO in one of the direct selling companies in Idaho championed legislation in Idaho that really, really, really devastates this issue. And it's really, really frustrating when you have and you know what, one of the things the DSA does really, really well is monitor this and lobby against this. They do a great job on that. It's interesting to me when I talk to people, they think that they can say and do whatever they want. And you know what, and company owners fall into the same sort of delusion when they're new and they're getting started. First-time company owners, they think, oh, they're independent. And the difficulty here is that the way the attorney generals and the FTC is going to look at this, if you knew that your independent professional was doing XYZ that was against the law and you didn't do anything about it, you are liable for that. So whether it's making income claims, whether it's product claims, whatever it is, if an independent professional is doing something that is incorrect and wrong and illegal, and the company should have known and does not have a compliance department, does not monitor what's going on in the field, they can get in some deep trouble. And I've seen a lot of companies get in trouble because they were ignorant of this issue. Independent is independent to protect both parties, but independent doesn't mean separate. It doesn't mean that there's not a responsibility or on either side.
Now we're getting into a lot of compliance issues.
Well,
absolutely,
Mel,
it does.
Mel, I have an independent driver's license, but I still have to follow the law.
That's right.
And I have to drive according to the rules of the road. So I can be an independent contractor. I can be an independent distributor or an affiliate or whatever you want to call it, but I'm still an independent business person, but I have to follow the rules of the
country. Not only the legal rules, but also you're signing a contract. and you are obliged and obligated to fulfill that contract as an independent professional when you sign it with that company. And far too often we see independent professionals, they just simply do not read the contract as they're registering. They're excited, they want to get in, so they just sign their life away, and then they get filled a big business.
Claims, right?
Say it again?
You mean I can't make earning claims?
That's right.
Yeah. Well, I have if it's okay with you, let me share with you my personal example of independent contractor, because this is where I learned the definition. When I was working with that vacuum cleaner company, I was, for instance, a branch manager, and I earned 50% of the profits from the office. So there was the sales minus the expenses equals profits, and I got 50%. But when we started to grow our sales force, the company owner at that time was brilliant. He figured that if we take all of our salespeople and go from being employees, so here's the punchline, employee versus independent contractor, we don't have to worry about paying their medical benefits. We don't have to worry about paying their Social Security or their FICA. And in essence, because those things are expenses, our profits would go up. That was the way it was sold to me. Employees had benefits. Independent contractors, you could get away with having the employee without having to pay his benefits. So we still told people to show up every day. We still told people what they needed to do. We still treated them like employees, but for tax purposes, independent contractors were great because we saved on health care benefits, this and that, the FICA scores, and all that sort of stuff that we have over in the United States.
I don't remember what year that was, but when I started, we did the same thing, but then the laws changed, and you could not require anybody to do anything anymore.
Well,
you
could say
yes
and report,
and request,
have to their own.
But you couldn't require, and you couldn't punish them if they didn't do it.
Right.
Yeah.
So that also leads to the point of, I think, where the government comes in sometimes is, wait a minute, you can't have it both ways. You can't treat them like employees and then not pay their taxes or not be somehow on the hook for their taxes as independent contractors. So then it's a matter of, well, wait a minute, whose website are they using? Well, they're using the companies. Can they use other ones? No, our compliance department says no. What can they say? Well, they can't say this, they can't say that, they can't say a whole bunch of other things. What can they say? Only what the company says is okay. And then we bridge that gap between independent contractor status and employee status, and there's been some waves of we want to make these people employees. And just imagine what would happen if now all of your companies had to worry about hiring them as employees as opposed to independent contractors for just the tax purposes, having nothing to do
of
with
Obamacare.
Whatever else they do.
Of Obamacare.
You know, there is a very, very, very bright line. It's not blurred. It's very, very clear what an independent contractor is. And some companies, particularly on the competition side of this industry, the non-compete side of it, want to treat independent contractors as employees and say, hey, you can't compete with, you know, you can't go,
right.
If you leave my company, you can't go over there and work that company. You know, there are lines where as independent, you know, if I'm an independent contractor and I paint your house, you can't tell me. But the question is, did I sign a contract with you that says you can only paint my house? Right.
And guys,
so,
we're almost done, Mel. We got 20 seconds. I'll let you wrap this one up. But remember, we've got 20
I was just going to say, so there's a difference between what the law says at a company at a government level and what your agreement as independent contract says. So I was just going to follow back around and just say, make sure to read your contract too.
Absolutely.
Because you're also bound
totally
by
agree
it.
With that.
Excellent.
Here, my
well, guys, with this event,
is that the hour goes by so fast.
I know. We are done. So I got to push some buttons. I'm grabbing the hook. Thanks for everybody being here. MLM After Hours. We'll see you on the next Odd Monday. Thanks.
Thank you.
You've been listening to the MLM After Hours segment on Building Fortunes Radio. This special segment of MLM After Hours has been sponsored by the MLMIA. MLM After Hours will be broadcast live every first Monday of each month at 10 p.m. Eastern Time. Join us live or listen to the MLM After Hours segment on Building Fortunes Radio by visiting www.buildingfortunesradio.com. Tune in often, spread the word, invite your friends, and share this with your business partners. MLM After Hours will give you the information you can use to succeed in the home-based business industry. The entire content of this show consists of the research and experience the opinions and the views of the callers, guests, and the hosts on this show. It does not constitute legal advice or specific counsel for you, as each individual should always seek individual guidance and counsel for matters related to themselves specifically. We hope you learned and enjoyed the MLM After Hours show. On behalf of Peter Mingles, the MLMIA, our distinguished guests, and myself, we wish you the success you deserve and are willing to work for. Thanks for listening.